Do you want to learn how to invest, or are you an entrepreneur and want to build companies in the regenerative food and agriculture space? Or do you work in big ag and big food and want to really move the needle? We have developed a new video course for you. Find out more on investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/course or in the show notes description below.
A lot of updates with Abby Rose of VitaCycle on the role and the potential of AI in observation for farmers. And why did someone who didn't really need the money, plus had serious and reasonable questions about the tendency of startups, both in and outside the regen space, to keep raising money, ended up raising funding? Not a traditional, potentially extractive way, but a revenue share and a service fee and a cap. We unpack this slightly alternative and unusual investment vehicle. And we talk about the power of transparency within a company and why regenerative viticulture is so interesting. The wine industry is lagging behind in regenerative practices, but has the potential to leapfrog ahead. This is the Investing in Regenerative Agriculture and Food podcast, Investing as if the planet mattered, where we talk to the pioneers in the regenerative food and agriculture space to learn more on how to put our money to work to regenerate soil, people, local communities, and ecosystems while making an appropriate and fair return. Why my focus on soil and regeneration? Because so many of the pressing issues we face today have their roots in how we treat our land and our sea, grow our food, what we eat, wear, and consume. And it's time that we as investors, big and small, and consumers start paying much more attention to the dirt/soil underneath our feet. To make it easy for fans to support our work, we launched our membership community, and so many of you have joined us as a member. Thank you. If our work created value for you, and if you have the means, and only if you have the means, consider joining us. Find out more on gumroad.com/investinginregenag. That is gumroad.com/investinginregenag. Or find the link below. Welcome to another episode. Today with the co-founder of VitaCycle and Farmarama, and of course, friend of the show. We have had two interviews before and a webinar, and we saw each other many times. So welcome back, Abby. But it's been a few years. We just counted 2022 with Nicole Masters was the last time. So as we didn't talk online, on air, let's say last year, we had to have this discussion early 2024. So welcome back, Abby.
Thank you, Cohen. So good to be here. It's been exciting to follow all of the episodes and happenings in between since 2022. So thanks for having me back.
Absolutely. And we were pre-show discussing as well Farmarama, which we're going to discuss as well. You just launched. I still have to listen to the first episode, but when this is out, there will be multiple episodes already out on the role or the big question or one of the big questions of our time in food and ag, of meat. So I'm very curious. I'll put a link below for anybody interested in that. Definitely go and check it out because it's a deep dive, which is needed. But for somebody that didn't listen to our first interview, which was in 2019, so I can completely understand that. Intro is always such a shitty word, but if you sit in a plane or in a train next to somebody and they ask, what do you do? Or at a dinner party, maybe, in a few sentences, how do you describe? And then we're going to unpack VitaCycle, of course, a bit more and everything that has happened over the last couple of years.
I always love this question. At VitaCycle, we make apps to support farmers to make more regenerative decisions on farm. They're very much focused on the power of observation and then really using those observations to learn from and improve on your practices to essentially improve outcomes from a regenerative perspective.
And which is fascinating.
I should go into a little more detail.
Because the title of the first interview was, please don't do another random technology, which is going to save us all. And yet you're building technology, which is an interesting tension we unpack there, or not a contradiction, but an interesting balance, because this came out of your need for technology. Like you need your need for technology running a vineyard and much more in Chile. We're not anti-technology here, but we're appropriate and applicable and enabling technology. And I think that's
exactly
so when they say, oh, tech for everything, what do you answer to that? Or how do you return that ball of in a tennis match?
Yeah, I think it's about being super clear that this is technology to enable. I think enable is the right word. It's about enabling those on the ground who are doing the work to learn from and build on their knowledge as they go, and to really learn from patterns essentially over time and between plants. And because I think you know, a lot has changed in farming in the last 50 years, just in terms of literally what it looks like on the ground. You know, there's not many people who grow up on a farm, inherit that farm, and spend their whole life living on that farm and working on that farm anymore. Because that's, you know, that's a certain type of knowledge that you gain. And so then you have like 40 years experience being in one place. And of course, you know that it's really boggy in that corner and the wheat grows really well over here. That's not really how things happen anymore, or it's not as common that it happens like that. And so what our two apps, so let's Soil Mentor and Sectamentor, what they're really about is like helping to bring that kind of knowledge and information together in a digital form, so that as people come and go, or you know, things change, ownership changes, all these other things that have kind of come into play and are more frequent, that body of knowledge can remain and that people can still learn from it. And it almost is like an asset or a part of the land more than it is the people, in a way. Does that make sense?
That's a fascinating way. Absolutely. A fascinating way of painting the picture. So I think, no, it's super clear. And I think it makes an excellent point of the power of observation, which will come back, I think, multiple times in this conversation. But the power of being on the same land for 40 years and potentially 40 harvests, obviously, depending on what crops you grow. But to be able to observe every year the same place at the same moment, in the same moment in the season, et cetera, that is just very rare, or is getting even rarer over time. So how do we use technology, I think is what you're saying, to sort of replace it, or at least hold it connected to the land. So if another land steward comes in, he or she can access that without having to build up their own 40 years, which of course we don't have that time. Is that a fair description?
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly kind of where I see the role of technology can be incredibly helpful in this space. So it's very different than technology being the answer. It's much more about technology being the enabler.
And so when you think about that and all the hype we've seen recently on AI, I think everybody puts AI now in their title somewhere just to help. Like, how do you think about that? Just to throw in a deep one and a rabbit hole. How do you think about that power that seems to suddenly be there, although it's not so sudden, but still it seems to have arrived relatively recent? Like, how could that help or hurt what you just described as an enabler and not taking over?
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely something I think, you know, at VitaCycle we're always thinking about. And I guess hopefully more broadly in the regenerative agriculture and technologies worlds, hopefully we're all thinking about that. But I've talked to quite a few farmers about it, to quite a few regenerative farmers, and my instinct at this time is that there's lots of little ways that AI can actually be an enabler. In this context. So in the same way that, you know, in a way our apps are very low tech, you know, they're allowing those observations to be stored and then some analysis of that. And in the same way, it's like almost what are some of the simplest uses of AI? So for example, one thing we're currently investigating, is, you know, can we use AI to help auto, label isn't quite the right word, but let's just use it here. Auto label photographs of land So that when a farmer is out there and they're wanting to understand, you know, the impact of the grazing after and before putting animals in a field, if you could just take a photo and the AI could help you say, okay, well, you know, 30% of it's bare ground, 25% grasses. 45% residues, something like that. So to me, that's a very simple application that is potentially, you know, supporting the person in the field to make that quick assessment. And in a way, what I'm excited about is that it could act as like a confidence builder. And that might seem quite a weird thing to say, but
It does potentially take away a bit the observation piece away from them,
How
does it enable more observation?
But I think actually, so one of the issues that we found, you know, I've been working to empower farmers on the ground through observation for, you know, 5-6 years now, maybe even longer since the idea had come into play. And one of the biggest challenges I find is actually the confidence of the person on the ground, the land steward, whoever it is, to actually say, well, this is what I'm seeing, and to back that. Because for so long, that power and it's been taken away from them. It's been, you know, considered they needed to defer to an expert to really assess that kind of thing. So that's where what I mean by a confidence builder. It's like, of course, the farmer can make the assessment in the moment, and they can use the auto assessment to help kind of back up, you know, is that reasonable what they're seeing? So, yeah, but I do agree there is a risk that it can actually facilitate less observation. That's where, for me, it's like, you know, what are the ways that we can make it still having the farmer actually be in the field to be there at the point of observation, but just making that observation somehow enabling them more in those observations. Sorry, that seems, you can see I'm not clear cut on it. It's really not obvious to me exactly where the line is. And maybe there isn't a line. Maybe it's actually a real spectrum of what is reasonable or possible, and it will be different in different cases. So we're feeling into it. So let's see where this goes. I mean, there are other applications that are much simpler as well.
And let's unpack those, but I think it's a feeling into it. And I think there's a general generalization I can make that most farmers are not observing enough. Mm-hmm. And anything we can do to enable, make them feel more confident, store more of that, because we just don't have enough eyes on the land to really understand. And I think we really don't understand a lot.
Yes.
And the more eyes we have on the land, probably the more we will realize we don't understand a lot. So what are other simple applications or other things you are investigating or are looking into where this current boom can help?
Like another example is, auto analysis of written material or scanned documents, being able to quickly turn that into digital information, numerical information. So drawing numerical information out of old documents. That is something that, you know, I mean, that's not just a farming specific application, but you can see in farming, you know, how many farmers have scans of all of their old results from different fields, and, you know, being able to bring that data into the store of information previously seemed like an absolutely massive undertaking. Whereas now could be quite quick. And that's something the AI could really help with.
And then when thinking about like this power of observation, what are some stories that come to mind or some farmer stories you've seen over the last years where that really where, of course, soil mentor help, but also in general, just that triggering of we need to observe way more, partly through our phone camera, but definitely also through our eyes and our hands and our smile, etc. Like when I say the power of observation, what is a story from the field that comes to mind?
Yeah, good question. So I guess one that immediately comes to mind is Claire Hill at Planton Farm. She used to work at a farm in Oxfordshire, FAI.
Shout out to Claire.
Yeah. One of the 10 regen indicators, which is part of our what we offer, is something we developed with Nicole Masters. One of them is what we call the basal ground cover transect. Horrible name, but essentially it's looking at what is the ground cover over a 60 meter walk. And you stop every half meter or so and you look at the ground level and see what kind of ground cover is there. And so I always remember Claire, you know, saying it was all very well. There were some meadows that flooded each winter and were grazed in the summer. And they were having real issues kind of with burn off of grass in the summer and then obviously inundated with water in the winter. So it just seemed like an impossible situation. So she went out and it was kind of early spring, I think. And it looked to her like the land had a full cover as far as she could tell, kind of from the standing perspective. But when she actually did the basal ground cover transect, it turned out that it was about 50% bare soil. It was quite a high number. And wow. I think it was just like totally taken aback by that close, you know, on closer observation, on just taking, it takes, you know, maybe 10, up to 10 minutes to do that. But it's a completely different story when you actually look to that quick drive by, oh yeah, that field looks the same as last year, let's do this. It takes time, I think, observation, and just taking that time and doing that slightly more focused observation means that, you know, then she started to think completely differently about how to manage that area. Then it became about how to increase ground cover and how to graze in a different way, you know, allow those grasses to really establish better. Previously, I think they'd been more tightly grazed, so longer rest periods. Changing grazing management. So those are the kinds of things I think we're talking about.
And did you see changes year over year?
Yes. Well, she's no longer at that exact farm, but I'm pretty sure she told me the story after she'd started to see the changes. So within 2 years, I think they did start to see changes on that farm.
And with those 10 indicators, because I think they were just launched with Nicole the last time we talked in 2022, how has been the development or what have been, I mean, first of all, they've been put in practice and many farmers have used them, played with them, probably potentially criticized them. Like what has changed or how have you worked with that over the last almost 2 years?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's been really exciting because obviously when we last spoke, we just launched them and it was somewhat of an unknown. So it's been, we've worked with quite a few. What we've seen is really that we've worked with quite a few different farmer organizations. And that has brought, well, for me, that's brought a lot of joy to see that, you know, they're really, the 10 regen indicators really speak to a need on the ground, which is enabling farmers to, just like that example with Claire, it's like to be able to make observations that really count and that they can feel more confident in, that also the organization can feel more confident in, and that everyone can kind of learn from. And that's really the space it feels like they're holding. And that's quite unique. You know, it's different than, for example, satellite data, which actually usually is really only helpful to organizations. Satellite data doesn't often tell the farmer much that they don't know because they're there on the ground. So that's the space the regen indicators are holding. So I can give some examples. Like, we work with one, maybe you've had them on the show actually, Regenerate Outcomes. Do you know them? Or Regenerate Ventures,
no.
I think is their
no, I don't know them.
Venture. Okay.
Should I?
No. Well, I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway, they offer a program in the UK, where it's a carbon, essentially carbon credits program. But the way that they offer it is they partnered with Understanding Ag in the United States, and they have actually a UK arm now. And they
not,
are
not
providing,
a bad group, yeah.
Yeah, they're providing the coaching to support farmers in building more regenerative methods on their farms, on the ground. And at the same time, they're using Soil Mentor to kind of document their observations in the day-to-day, and as well as doing the 10 regen indicators, ideally twice a year, focused in certain fields to really learn more about what's going on underground in those fields. And this all complements the, then, you know, the actual carbon verification is done. I think it's once every 3 to 5 years where the verifier or, you know, an outside external company comes in and essentially extracts information about the carbon in those soils. But I think to me, it's so much more exciting, I think, both for the farmers, but also, let's say, from the land's perspective, to have those people on the ground gathering the information, sharing it, and learning from it through that kind of coaching cycle.
And from the trader's perspective,
building.
I think.
Yeah.
Because instead of getting WhatsApp updates and maybe Facebook group or whatever the feedback loop, but it's mostly WhatsApp, I think, is in this case, you get structured observations that can really, even if you're not there every day or every week or every month as a trainer or as a consultant, you can really, it doesn't replace being there, but it gets pretty close and you can actually probably help if you get these observations in a structured way.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, it allows the farmers to communicate their point, you know, to people who aren't necessarily there. Because that's the reality is that that coaching team, obviously they do visit, but they're not able to be there as often as they're. I think farmers are able to have 8 coaching sessions a year. So they're not visiting 8 times a year. So allowing that kind of both the visual and the context-based structured setting when having those coaching sessions, I think is really, really important. And also it turns out that data, the carbon verifier does want to see evidence that farmers are taking actions, you know, in between these 3 to 5 year official testing periods. So it just feels like it's a win-win-win. you know, the farmers are learning through developing these observations on the ground. So you have both your more general observations, which are just like, there's, I don't know, the grass is doing better over here than it was last year or less reeds here, these kinds of things. But alongside that, they're being, you know, getting new skills by being able to go and dig holes and start to learn what does it mean to have rhizosheaths on your roots. You know, that's one of the regen indicators. Or why would I be interested in rooting depth? Another of the regen indicators. You know, going and looking at these things and starting to understand why those are helpful indications of the performance of that field and how effectively you're able to build soil health in that field. And hence potentially carbon levels. Kind of bringing that all together is really what I see the regen platform is doing and the space that's filling. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And actually the question that came up or the insight, like, is it being used in in ag school and education at all, because this sounds, the 10 indicators, what they mean and why they're important, etc., sound like really, really important to learn when you're learning to become a farmer, which of course is, you do on a job, but let's say in a more structured education scene where most farmers complain about, or at least the region farmers complain about, they want to send their children there because that's not where you learn like the cutting edge of farming or modern farming at the moment. But have you been engaging with any structured education organizations on the farming side that want to use this or are already using it?
Yeah, it's a great question. And my experience so far has been certainly not the kind of the standard ones. There have been a few more actually from the market gardening perspective who have got in touch and been interested. But yeah, it's definitely much slower to change there in my experience. That's where I think where we do have interest is, well, yeah, from coaching programs like the Roots to Regeneration one that Claire Hill and Caroline Grindrod launched, that's due to start, I think, in March, starting in March. You know, those kinds of educational journeys, let's say, definitely Soil Mentor, you know, that's where we definitely see interest, and it's just such a perfect fit because it's like, it's a partner on that journey of learning. And it provides, as you say, you know, it provides that structured way for people to understand what does it mean to build soil health and to be able to access that visually for themselves. And so that's where we've seen it has fit in very nicely and seamlessly. In terms of the more conventional institutions, I haven't reached out to them either, so not yet. Watch this space.
Yeah, but I think they should come to you anyway. But let's shift gears a bit, because then you decided to raise some funding. Actually, you raised a significant amount of money, more money than most people will ever see in their lifetime in one chunk. Maybe when they buy a house, but you're sort of not really seeing that money. The bank is wiring that. So you decided, and that wasn't that is a tension actually, to decide to raise outside funding. We've discussed it the first time.
Yes,
you were on. We've discussed it offline quite a few times on the role of money in this space, in the regeneration space. What made you decide to take on outside funding to grow, or to grow faster, or to do more, even though probably organically you would have got there as well with the Vita Cycle, because you have a lot of customers, you're growing, you're doing something extremely useful for the space. So it wasn't that you needed the money to stay afloat.
No. It's a good question why we went. I think in the end, it was a little bit about experimentation for ourselves as well. I think I've been clear before that I definitely, the ethos at VitaCycle has been about organic growth. And I've always been reticent to push too hard, because I think that, you know, you and I, we've been around here, I mean, nowhere near as long as some people, but certainly a good 6 odd years. And the space does change, but it takes time for people to come in and for things to shift. And for farmers also, they need time to, you know, recalibrate and get on board with some of these ideas. And so for me, just pumping money in, although it can speed things up from a tech perspective and a business perspective, the farming world isn't always able to, it can't just speed things up. So to me, there's always been an underlying tension in that. And that's why I've resisted going down the kind of large lump sums of outside investment route. But at this point, it did feel like there is a surge in interest and momentum is shifting at a pace that we hadn't seen previously. I don't know if you agree, but certainly that's been my experience in the last 2 years and maybe three. Mm. And so there, suddenly it did become apparent that actually it felt like demand was rising faster than we could potentially fulfill on it. And so let's explore what it means to take some outside funding. And I mean, it wasn't a huge sum, like in business terms, it's not a huge sum. But it felt also, you know, it was from Be the Earth and A-Team. They actually did it together. And we talked to them for like at least a year and a half or maybe more about different ways of doing this. And when they came to us with the revenue backed loan option, that just felt like a really positive way to go about it. And so from our kind of regenerative business lens, that felt like an opportunity to do this in a way that aligned with, you know, what we were about.
And so for people that are like, what does that mean? Can you unpack it a bit?
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, I guess maybe some of my resistance also is that I don't have a background in finance. And so I find a lot of the financial world, a lot of jargon, and somewhat intimidating at times because people, you know, there is a lot to understand. It can become quite complex quite quickly, but I'll talk about it in my terms and you can help me if I need it. But from what I understand, a revenue backed loan, essentially what it looks like is that we are paying back the loan based off of a certain percentage of our revenue, over the years that we take to pay back that loan. And so there's no interest on the loan. There is a service fee for each year that we take to pay back. But essentially there's not kind of this looming pressure of a set amount that we're going to have to pay back regardless of our revenue. Or, you know, what if COVID hit or the year COVID hit and suddenly your revenues plummet? It's not like you're going to have to face defaulting on the payback. It feels much more like there's a shared risk between whoever's giving the loan and whoever's taking the loan, in that it all depends on the revenue. That's what is determining how much is being paid back each year.
And just to, like, when does it stop? Is there like a capped return, or is the return the service fee, or how does that work compared to a normal interest payment or an interest payment, or like when is it done, or are you going to be paying this for a long time?
Yeah, good question. I mean, it's a small amount. It was only £50,000. So I certainly hope we're not paying back for a long time. But that we didn't actually have a cap on it. So maybe that was something a good thing to think about if we were to go for more. So we pay back 5% of our revenue annually. And the service fee is £2,500 a year. And the only restriction, we can pay it back in full. The only restriction on it actually was that we have to pay back at least 3 years of the service fee. And we did have a payback holiday.
To not have it like returned immediately.
Yeah. And we had a payback holiday of 24 months, actually. So we haven't had to pay back any of the loan yet because it was issued in September 2022. So first payback will be September this year. So yeah, the return for them is the service
fascinating.
Fee.
Fascinating. And then however long it takes, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean,
which is interesting from an incentive perspective, because they sort of want you to go longer.
Yes, they do.
And you want to go faster. But of course, that also incentivizes. But it incentivizes, I mean, longer would also mean a higher chance of default, and shorter, of course, a smaller one. So there is mixed incentives there for the investor or the funder. And so what did this funding enable you to do, and compared to just continue? Like, talking to funders for a year, setting this up, negotiating takes a lot of time. So my second question would be, was it worth it? But for now, like, what it enabled you to do that you wouldn't have been able to do otherwise?
Well, I guess maybe just to be clear, it didn't take that much time, because it wasn't like we were spending all our time on the funding. It just, maybe I had 3 conversations over that year and a half. So it definitely didn't take much time. But what it enabled us to do was hire a good salesperson. And to hire a salesperson who was aligned with our regenerative business principles and values, and to offer a salary that, you know, it was basically to offer a salary that meant we could get a great person. Whereas previously we hadn't always had that option. And I would say, you know, obviously I had done a lot of the sales in the past. And as a co-founder, my remuneration was always looked different than hiring someone who is not a co-founder and therefore doesn't have any vested interest necessarily in the business. So it allowed us to kind of make that leap. And the other great thing about hiring salespeople, obviously, is it's kind of easy to see if it paid off. I'm happy to say 100% definitely paid off. So that was really great to just see have the experience of that being such a positive contribution to what we were doing. And we've learned a lot from it as well, just in terms of, you know, I guess as a co-founder, you can always, take on certain things because you think it's sort of your responsibility to do that. And that actually sometimes, in a way, that's what the loan kind of enabled, was this ability to just take a step back from taking on all that responsibility of sales and saying, actually, let's invite someone else in who can do a good job on this and give me some space to focus on other things as well. So that's been really, really positive.
And then was it worth it? I think the answer is yes. And are you considering, because this seemed also like a pilot, or like, I mean, it's a lot of money and in the business world, not a lot at the same time. So are you considering to do that again? And if so, why? Or if not, why not?
Good question. I mean, at the moment, so one of the things, this might be new since we last spoke, but one of the things that we've put in place in our business is that we now have everyone in the business is able to read the profit and loss and read the balance sheet. We all check in on those basically once a month in our objective key result updates. We all look at cash flow. We have different metrics that we're all looking at and understanding. And so it's been really interesting for people to, you know, really understand what it means to have a loan on the balance sheet. And so a lot of our conversations for one, I would say changing that setup of our business has been also one of the most important things we've done in the last 2 years, because it completely shifts everyone's relationship to the role they have and how that's supporting the objectives that we have.
You mean the transparency piece?
But also, you know, the business itself. Yeah, the transparency is unbelievably powerful. I was kind of scared to do it before we did it. I mean, I wasn't kind of, I was really scared to do it. And then now I've done it.
What was the most scary piece?
That is so...
What was the scariest piece of that?
Well, I think the scary thing is that a lot of people who haven't had to manage the business side of things actually have very little idea of, you know, how much cash you might actually have at any one moment, or, you know, oh, there are, you know, this, or how little, exactly. Like these things, you know, in the startup world, it's very common to have a 3 month runway, 3 to 6 month runway, and that still be reasonable. Whereas I think for most people who work in a business, if they really faced the reality of that, I think that it's really shocking for a lot of people. It's scary.
So you,
or I don't know if
might
you agree with that
away,
or not.
Or
but
they would like,
that's how I felt.
I don't know. I haven't taken a salary. I mean, now I am, but from ourselves. So it doesn't really, I know the runway. But
yeah.
So you were scared they would take it the wrong way. We're like, oh, we're actually, it's a super shaky, potentially shaky thing, even though it's very normal. And it's been like that for a long time, but it just never knew. And did that happen or did it go a different direction?
No, no, it didn't. I mean, I think at first people did, one or two people did say like, wow, I really had no idea. And I'm, you know, wow. But then they very quickly acclimatized to it, like literally within hours. And then it was from there on out, it was just like, suddenly it felt like a team effort to have the business side of things flourish as well as all the other things. Because already we already had transparency around objectives and key results on many other things. It was just like the pure, you know, the real nitty gritty of the profit and loss and balance sheet wasn't kind of exposed in that way, or wasn't transparent. And so, yeah, the team, we've really taken it on together and we really look at it together. So I guess the reason I'm bringing that up is that with the idea of, you know, a next round of investment, external investment, right now, okay, we could grow our sales team, but we're now in a place where we can do that ourselves. And I don't feel, so we will be doing that, but ourselves. And it doesn't feel like we absolutely need a huge, or an injection to get there. That would be my answer to that right now. But I mean, there's nothing to say that won't change in the next 12 months. And I feel like it is something that, you know, as a team, we're discovering and exploring.
Or is there the pressure on the other side now because of the transparency and the weight, let's say, of the loan and the service fee on your balance sheet and your cost? Is there the pressure of the team thinking, like, let's get rid of this as fast as possible? How do we pay it back and clean it up?
Yeah, there's a bit of that. But I think it's all relative, isn't it? Because you could also argue like, you know, was that loan actually a really good deal compared to what we could get today potentially? And therefore, why would you be in a rush to pay it back? So, you know, there are discussions to be had. And I think, I think that's what the transparency has brought is discussions. I mean, to be totally clear, you know, the decision making does still ultimately lie with myself and Inti, my co-founder. So it's not a completely completely flat structure in that sense.
Are you planning to change?
The transparency provides power in terms of discussions. Say that again, sorry.
Are you planning to move there eventually?
To move where? Sorry.
To a completely flat structure, like in terms of first transparency, then potentially maybe thinking of steward ownership, like how is that a step you envision at some point happening?
Yeah, I'm definitely interested in steward ownership. Yes. And definitely we are having conversations about moving. We're still in a relatively conventional ownership structure. It's a company limited by shares and Inti and I are the share or what? Yeah. Some it's kind of like that. But what I would say, so we have a discussion about that and we're just feeling into it. I, on the other hand, I have to say, I'm not really pro a totally non-hierarchical structure in terms of decision making. I don't know, that just, in my view, sometimes you need to have some sort of structure. I mean, of course, there's many different ways governance can look, but in a small business like this, it feels like having a few people who can just make a decision is a really helpful thing to have. And, you know, as we grow or our team gets bigger, of course, that I could start to feel differently about that. And I am part of other organizations that use, sociocracy as a mode of governance. And so I have seen that work as well. But yeah, for now, it does feel like in the business world, sometimes it can be really helpful to have some people who are going to just make the decisions for certain things.
And what would be your tips to other entrepreneurs on the funding you raised, or like a crucial thing to remember when you go down potentially this path, and also the transparency piece? Like what do you tell fellow entrepreneurs in the space or outside the space about this process?
Well, on the funding side, I mean, for me, what was really, really important is that I really trusted my relationship with the people who we ended up getting the loan from. So, I mean, that was the most vital bit, I would say. I built a relationship with them. I had a relationship across multiple different ways. They have a philanthropic arm to what they do, and I'd also supported them on some of that stuff. So I really knew what they were committed to, and I really knew it was aligned to what we were committed to. So for me, that made the whole process so much lighter. And yeah, the power of trust there is huge. Obviously, not everyone is in that position, but that was, I guess, also part of what enabled me to just say, okay, yes, we'll take the outside investment. And on the transparent business operating, I would say that, I mean, we're relatively small. There's only 6 people in our team right now. So, it wasn't the biggest logistical nightmare to do. But, I mean, the payoffs have been huge. So I would highly, highly recommend it. And I think from the team's perspective as well, I think they all feel like a whole new level of connectedness to what we're doing. And just at a new level of empowerment. Like, people are making decisions in totally different ways than they did previously. And I'm always kind of in awe of everyone.
It comes back to observation as well there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And yeah, it's really practicing what we preach.
And just to shift gears again a bit, because I also want to touch on wine actually, and the viticulture space, because since we last talked, you, like Soil Mentor has been, and you've been working a lot more in, let's say, the wine, quote unquote, the wine industry. Why is that? And what have you seen there? Can you report back to people that are not walking on vineyards every other day? I mean, you're working on one. Of course, you've been working in one, but actually many others besides your own vineyard, you have been engaged, let's say, with VitaCycle.
Totally, yeah. Well, I think so one of the things, just to give a bit of context, we have this app, Sector Mentor, which is much more focused on vineyards and a bit on agroforestry as well. And we actually just released the 10 regen indicators and the regen platform with Nicole Masters. We released that into Sector Mentor. So now that framework is available for viticulturists and agroforesters to use in their soils alongside their crops, their plants. And in a way, that's a culmination of many years of being part of and helping to build this regenerative viticulture movement. And I think it has reaching a new, more general regenerative agriculture. Regenerative viticulture is now kind of having more of a moment. It is definitely lagging behind the wider movement, but it's happening. So like, for example, in the middle of last year, I spoke at the International Master of Wine Symposium in Wiesbaden, Germany. I was part of a regenerative viticulture panel. I was kind of scared to go because Master of Wine is obviously a very well-respected qualification in the wine world. And it takes many years to acquire it. But actually, it was amazing to see the reception. And it felt like the wine world is ready for this communication about the importance of the soil, the importance of the water sources and water and how that's connected to wine. And I think that's something that has been missing from a lot of the wine conversations it has been missing, is that actually wine is connected to the changing climate, and wine is connected to carbon levels, and it's connected to water cycles, and it's connected to the health of our soils. Somehow they've avoided that for many years, but suddenly it feels like they're starting to cotton on to that.
Which is interesting.
So that was really exciting to see, and it was so well received.
Sector with terroir, with flavor and story and selling soil, are almost like the word sort of comes from there. But yet you're saying they're lacking behind, yeah, and they're starting to catch up.
Well, it's very interesting, because I would say when I started talking about regenerative in the viticulture space, one of the biggest barriers was that there was already a conversation about soil. But it's very much about the geology of the soil. So is it basaltic? Is it granitic? And it's actually nothing, or the conversation has been nothing to do with the biology of the soil. And there's been no acknowledgement of biology until very recently. And actually that's interesting. That shift has been interesting to see, is like, I'm starting to hear viticulturalists and some communication on bottles about the biology and health of the soil. So although it had been about soil, actually quite often people would talk about that the poor soils created some of the best wines, because it like stressed the vine and then you got better grapes. So actually I think that the fact that viticulture already had a connection with soil could have been one of the things that's actually held it back in terms of entering this other conversation around soil as a living kind of breathing organism or ecosystem that's connected to so many different cycles, and that the vines are part of that. I think that they've resisted that conversation for a while.
Which is fascinating, because if you see, I'm absolutely no wine expert, but I think a lot of the top wines, from what I hear, are applying a lot of biodynamic practices. In some cases, they're fully certified, even though they don't put it on the bottle because they're scared of selling less. And of course, we've seen the whole natural wine movement popping up, but it's much more about what happens in the canteen. So just to bust potentially a myth, do you need very poor soils to get a really good wine, or can really healthy, biologically active, thriving soils also produce a very nice wine?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I have to be clear, I'm not a wine expert either. So we should really talk to the masters of wine or the master sommeliers to get their opinion on that. But certainly that was what I heard coming back to me at that conference, was that more and more it's being understood that, you know, one of the reasons biodynamics, there were a few presentations at the conference, and, you know, one of the reasons biodynamics could potentially be, you know, it's often said that people can, or it's reflected in the flavor, in the experience of the wine. You can taste when a vineyard turns biodynamic, and that's reflected in the wine. I have to say, my taste buds, I'm pretty good, but I'm probably nowhere near that good. But anyway, when they look at some of the research around the microbial life in those wines, and then the microbial life in the soils, there's certainly evidence that shows that the biodynamic wines and the biodynamic soils have a different makeup of microbial life, which of course is what we would expect from a biodynamic farming perspective. But it's interesting to also understand that potentially that's reflected in the, you know, through the fermentation process. And then potentially that is what is affecting the flavor and the experience of the wine itself. I don't want to make any claims around that because that's the bit I know much less about. Someone like Mimi Castile or Justin Howard Snyder, mm-hmm. they're more able to speak to that side of it than I am.
But it's fascinating because the other side of the wine industry at this time, I don't have to do air quotes, which nobody sees anyway, but is that it's a massive pesticide and herbicide, a fungicide user. It's, and mostly, especially the industrial side of things, like the soil is definitely poor or is in a monoculture space and nothing is growing around it. I mean, that seems to be changing slightly a bit now, but it's not the beautiful pictures you see in the advertisement or on some of the websites all the time. They're beautiful examples and exceptions, but the general like commodity wine is probably sprayed more than you know or you want to know.
Yeah, 100%. No, I think the viticulture industry is a great user of pesticides and different applications, 100%. And I think, you know, they are vast monocultures. And in a way, one of the issues also with the viticulture industry is that those monocultures, the visual is sort of celebrated. Like I know a lot of people who they have this, you know, vision that they want a vineyard. And so they plant that vineyard and then they want to make sure that there's no weeds anywhere because that's like their vision of this perfect vineyard.
That's messy.
You know, which is exactly the opposite of what they want, what would really help those vines flourish and the soils flourish. It's an interesting world because in a way, you know, in most of the farming world, there's very little space for aesthetic considerations. And there's much excess
and
there,
and in wine
cash
it is.
Around. Oh, yeah. It's huge. Yeah, no, in the
now,
wine world.
I remember
world,
visiting
like,
two vineyards in Tuscany once to pick a location for a friend's party, and she couldn't visit. And the owner or the person that showed us around, one of them was an organic vineyard, and was apologizing for the messiness, like between the rows. Yeah, there are all these cover crops, but yeah, they're organic, so it's okay. Like she was really, and we were like, don't worry, that's a good thing. Yeah. Like we know there's not been, at least not been extremely bad stuff being sprayed, which probably is a good thing if you want to have a party nearby, outdoors, etc. So, but she was apologizing because it didn't look in that super visual, clean, which is very similar to row cropping, I think, at the end of the season. It's not like the season is not done until the plow is cleaned and stored in the shed and everything is nicely turned. We can see the same dynamics there, let's say.
Totally. Yeah, and I think I think the other thing that's actually changed things in the wine world in recent years, just to say, is that they have had to start focusing on resilience. Because if you look at like California, Australia, Chile, you know, and New Zealand, so key winemaking regions and vineyard regions, they've been affected by, you know, serious fires, serious floods. And so suddenly these vineyards, you know, these monoculture vineyards that have really poor soil are being washed away, essentially. You know, they're feeling the effects of the more extreme climatic conditions, or they're being washed away or they're being burnt. And so it's forced the viticulture world to think differently about how they're managing things on the ground, and to focus more on resilience. And often, you know, if you think about what's the first thing to think about when you're thinking about improving resilience, really, soil is the ultimate provider of resilience in a farming operation. And if you can build your soils and build healthy soils, then that really will support you through those more extreme moments as best as possible. So I think that also has had a big impact on, certainly from the vineyard perspective, you know, we need to think differently about how we're doing things here. So that's been obviously devastating, but also catalyzed things into a certain direction, which has been good to see as well.
And there's so many other rabbit holes we can go into in the viticulture one. We will save that for other episodes. But the big difference, it feels like as well, as you mentioned before, there's cash in this sector, like compared to the potato industry or the grain industry, etc. Yes. Like this is where not everybody's making cash. There's a lot of outside cash, like hobby cash, let's say, coming in. But there's definitely money going around in the wine industry. Yes. And that should, could that help? Or like, do you see signs of that that could fuel this momentum that's there too? And the aesthetics might help if we change our vision of aesthetics. But like, do you see this, they could sort of leap in front compared to the rest of the regen space?
Yeah, I think the opportunity is that exactly as you said, there is, there's a lot of almost hobby money, you could call it, or I would say there's a lot of people with money who desire to be part of the viticulture industry in some way. And so I think there's opportunity there in terms of for those people, hopefully some of those people are listening to your podcast and they are excited about regenerative. And if those people start to invest in the viticulture industry and world, I think it could change really quickly because I don't know why, I actually don't know why this is, but it does feel like in my experience, the people on the ground in the viticulture industry often they are more open to, I shouldn't generalize like this, but this has been, for the vineyards that I've visited, people are quicker to be able to shift practices. And maybe that is just because there's more money. So it's quicker and easier to like change your equipment, you know, seed different covers. But it does feel like once people get going on this in the vineyard, it can be a shift that happens more quickly. I guess also it's because their crop, you know, is a perennial crop. And vines are pretty resilient often. So they keep producing even as you're making the changes. Whereas sometimes when you're transitioning in a row cropping situation, you're having to make some more extreme changes to your actual cropping situation than you have to in viticulture. So in some ways, maybe it's easier to start to experiment and shift things. I haven't really thought that through though. So maybe that's, you know, I could easily be, someone could contest my point there, I think.
No worries. You can share it here and we'll see if we get a lot of pushback. And I think it's a perfect end to this this conversation and this check-in conversation we've had. It's been almost 2 years and a lot has happened, but it's good to see a lot of things has stayed the same as well. And so thank you so much for, first of all, the work you do, obviously pushing this space on so many different levers. We didn't even touch on Farmarama and the podcast you help manage and obviously also run. But that will be for another time. So thank you so much for the work you do to push the space and, of course, for coming on here to share about it.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thanks so much for the work you do, Cohen, as well. And just I'm excited to be part of all these conversations. And I forgot to say, but I did want to have a shout out to, I really enjoyed your podcast with Reginaldo Hazlett-Marroquin the other day. The distinctions he was making around tree range farms and chickens and the indigenous and colonizer mindsets. I really, really appreciated that. So thanks so much for sharing that conversation. And yeah, I'm excited to have those kinds of narratives appearing in this world.
Thank you so much. I will definitely put a link to Reggie's conversation or the conversation we had with Reggie in the description below. Thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. For the show notes and links we discussed in this episode, check out our website, investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/posts. If you like this episode, why not share it with a friend or give us a rating on Apple Podcasts? That really helps. Thanks again and see you next time.